Hi, I'm Teresa from Pacific Paradise in Humboldt County. We support Radio for Peace International, the people's voice.
This is Scott Fratcher with Radio for Peace International, and today we're going to air a speech by John Taylor Gatto. John Taylor Gatto is one of today's most interesting writers on education. He has written many articles on the topic and is perhaps most well known for his book, Dumbing Us Down, The Invisible Curriculum of Compulsory Schooling. As a former New York City and New York State Teacher of the Year, John Taylor Gatto has an inside-the-trenches perspective on education, and his criticism cannot easily be written off. John Taylor Gatto points to many anachronisms in history, including that George Washington, with no schooling until he was 11, and then only 2 years of school, could handle geometry and trigonometry that would challenge many college students today. He became the architect of his own estate and started several successful businesses as a young man. Gatto tells us that today, no public school in the United States is set up to allow a George Washington to happen. Washingtons in the bud stage are screened, browbeaten, or bribed to conform to a narrow outlook on social truth. Boys like Andrew Carnegie, who begged his mother not to send him to school, as well as on his way to immortality and fortune at the age of 13, would be referred today for psychological counseling. Thomas Edison would find himself in a special ed unit. His particular genius had been tamed. I should say that the John Taylor Gatto speech that you are about to hear was given to me by a friend on a sailboat who was home educating his children. It was only after I asked repeatedly how his children seemed to be so well educated at such a young age that he then said to me I should listen to the speech and then investigate the difference between homeschooling and home education. John Taylor Gatto was about 70 years old when he gave this speech in 2001.
I'm here today to make you feel good about your choice to homeschool. And since I never did that myself, the best way I can do my job is to tell you some of the awesome secrets of public schooling, of which I know quite a few, the secrets that never get into the newspapers. And when we're done together today, I'm sure you're going to feel even better about your decision to homeschool. Coming west on the airplane from New York, I was reading a surprising book about the fast food industry called Fast Food Nation. Have any of you read that yet? Three or four. Okay. Well, somebody held up a copy of it. Okay. Over 50% of all the restaurant profit in America goes to places like McDonald's and Domino's. And they control pretty much the potato business, the beef business, the onion, ketchup, and mustard world. They're the second largest distributor of toys in the world, and lots of other things. That entire industry, the largest employer in America, was completely built and developed by high school dropouts and otherwise unschooled or lightly schooled individuals. If you read Fast Food Nation, it's an eye-opener. This gigantic global industry was created exclusively by high school dropouts, not a single college degree in the bunch. Now think what that means, a hefty chunk of our gross national product was invented out of thin air by enterprising young people who went on to provide work for college graduates, MBAs, accountants, ad agencies, hotshots, and so on. That's intriguing, isn't it? The bad part is that the food is filthy and even dangerous. I was horrified to learn from Fast Food Nation Now, get ready for this, that several dozen people a year, and this is every year, you can chart it like a stock price, drop dead from eating fast food hamburgers, that the potatoes have twice the saturated fat than the meat does, that hundreds of people every year are hospitalized shortly after their fast food meal has digested, things like that. Fast Food Nation, it's worth a read, and I don't get anything for plugging it. Your kids will love it. Do we have that McDonald's thing up there? We have the. Well, put the baby up again. Thanks, Mike. You're probably aware that many schools have already franchised out their fast food operations to McDonald's, Taco Bell, Dr. Pepper, and the rest, and that these foods, including sweet soda pop, have frequently been targeted by medical groups as important contributors to a nationwide epidemic of obesity among young people. Now, I'm no one to talk, but I'm 70, and according to the AMA Journal, 30% of the young people in the country are technically obese. That seems like an awfully high price for our school authorities to be willing to pay for the convenience of outsourcing food provision and making a buck at it. At the least, I think we could agree it's a childish thing to do on this basis, this rationale. Solving one problem in the present by making another problem for the future, it's like sweeping dirt under the rug or something, and I clearly remember doing that as a boy without ever hearing that you were supposed to do it if you were a boy and you weren't supposed to do it if you were mature. As long as we have fast food and childishness on the table, let me offer another example of the two things. This time the childishness is of the sneaky variety, like talking about one's friends behind their back, which is a childish thing to do because you're not aware that it always gets back to the people you talk about behind your back. I think you have to live a long time before you realize that. In this instance, the circumstances were as surprising to me as finding out that local schools all over the country are willing to sell McDonald's hamburgers when Fast Food Nation says the little meat patties are saturated with fecal matter because of the slaughterhouse procedures the corporation uses. Now, if the guy turning up the burner turns it up high enough, then apparently all the little bugs that live on that stuff get killed, but often they're, you know, ditty-bopping with their friends, and it doesn't, and that's accounts for the several dozen people who drop dead from their Big Mac every year. Now, the surprise I'm referring to here is, I think, a little closer to home for parents, and it comes from a speech Lee Iacocca, then the CEO of Chrysler Corporation, made in Buenos Aires, Argentina, in 1993. Now, is it possible that Iacocca could say different things to Argentinians than Americans? Not likely, but in fact, true. Iacocca was speaking about using schooling, or education as he called it, as a way to lessen unemployment. I mean, not a day goes by that a newspaper or television doesn't say, you know, if we get better education, we won't have problems of unemployment. But that's not what Iacocca said to the Argentine audience. He said that that was a terrible idea. Try to imagine any American CEO saying such a thing in public in the United States. He'd be publicly reviled. So closely do we believe that the one follows the other. We've been taught that over and over again, haven't we, that good schooling is needed for good jobs, even though the billionaires that own the fast food businesses were lightly schooled themselves. We still hold the school job connection as a secular gospel. And here's what Iacocca said down there in Argentina in 1993. Every word is his. I've changed nothing. I'm bothered by the memory of what happened in Germany. This is Lee speaking. Education was put forward there, too, as the solution to unemployment, and the result was hundreds of thousands of frustrated professionals who then turned to socialism and rebellion. I wonder if it wouldn't be better for the unemployed to smarten up and go straight to McDonald's to find a job. The idea that people who know too much are dangerous is an old one, of course, but it isn't something that American leaders allow themselves to talk about in the open. So Iacocca must have felt himself on very safe ground down there at the end of the world, safe enough to flaunt a little reckless honesty. For if education isn't the answer in Argentina, it's fair to say it wouldn't be the answer in California either. The number one civilian job in the United States is working for a fast food chain, and nobody would be silly enough to argue that that takes much of an education. In fact, if you went down the list of the country's top 10 jobs as published every year by the Labor Department and its predicted top 10 for the next decade, you'd see that education doesn't play a vital hand in many of them, in fact, in any of them from some perspectives. It only gets in the way. That add that together with Iacocca's warning that educated people are dangerous, and you have all you need to come to terms with the dumbing down of American schools. Somebody thinks it's a safeguard against, what did Iacocca call it? Rebellion. It's very interesting because he's a lower middle class guy from Pennsylvania, which is my own home state. So he must have been taught that idea as he passed up through the corporate hierarchy. This idea that America's corporate leadership has an adversarial outlook on ordinary citizenry is an unsettling notion. In the absence of no more information than Lee Iacocca's sneaky remark in Argentina, I'd be inclined to discourage you from harboring any suspicions that America's children are being held in captivity and dumbed down in some colossal experiment to train consumers early, even if stupid, childish people are better customers for poop-filled hamburgers than educated ones. But unfortunately, Iacocca's reckless remark is not the only clue we have that something is afoot that should cause us all to shudder about the world our kids and grandkids will have to contend with. Three top executives of Archer Daniels Midland, that's the place that advertises itself as the supermarket to the world, went to federal prison in 1999 for conspiracy. Among various exhibits placed on record by the prosecution was a secretly recorded meeting between Archer Daniels Midland and highly placed Japanese executives in which the president of the corporation said this. This is an exact quote, not a word has been changed. "We have a saying at this company, our competitors are our friends and our customers are the enemy." That's exactly like a familiar teacher administrator saying I heard over and over and over again in different words during the 30 years I spent as a public school teacher. I heard that the kids are animals and the parents are our enemies. I first got wind that childishness might have a political function from James Bryant Conant, president of Harvard for 30 years, High Commissioner of Germany after World War II, a top executive on the atomic bomb project, and the father of the comprehensive high school.
I'm Jim Farrell, and I'm a student and a critic of the Three Gorges Dam project that's being built by the People's Republic of China on the Yangtze River, and I support Radio for Peace International.
You are listening to Radio for Peace International and a speech by John Taylor Gatto. John Taylor Gatto prescribes the difference between homeschooling and home education and how to bring the most out of your children. You are listening to Radio for Peace International. Radio for Peace International is completely listener-sponsored. If you like the speech, please consider logging on to our website, www.rfpi.org, www.rfpi.org, and see how you can help support Radio for Peace International.
America, a big fish in any pond. Conant led me to the actual purposes of forced schooling in 20th century America, but before we find out what they are, I need to get the important idea of boredom established and out of the way. Could I just get one more transparency? I have special plans for the future first, and then the one that I call hookers in training. Okay. As a boy, my granddad grabbed me by the ears one day when I said I was bored. I couldn't have been more than 7 years old. And he told me that only childish people get bored. I was not ever to say that within his hearing again, that I was bored, because the obligation to amuse myself or enlighten myself was nobody else's but my own. So I was to quit passing the buck. I never forgot that. As a school teacher, I came to discover that American secondary schools are places of exquisite boredom on purpose. The only people who escape are those with a highly developed inner life. But you can't have a highly developed inner life unless you have a historical dimension and an artistic dimension and a philosophical dimension and a number of other inner states that are thoroughly discouraged by the training of schools. Schools are laboratories of extended childishness. Even the advanced classes are maddeningly childish, and as significant as the boredom of young people is the poorly concealed fact that teachers in these institutions are bored too. Their dispirited speech, their low energy, and their constant whining is the giveaway. If you ask school kids why they're bored, they always give the same few answers. They say the work is stupid, that it makes little sense, that they already know it. They say they want to be doing something important, not just sitting around. The teachers themselves aren't interested in what they teach. And that in any case, they don't know very much. And when you ask school teachers the same question, why they're bored, they say it's the kids' fault. The kids are rude. They aren't interested in anything but grades. So how can a teacher be interested? It's a catch-22, you see. Anyone who looks at schools closely with an open mind and a sense of proportion becomes aware what childish places they are, how many kids and even teachers are held prisoner in a childhood they would willingly leave if they knew how and if the institution permitted it. if we're going to talk about childishness as we are, we need to agree on some definitions. So I'd like you to mentally create a yardstick, a continuum from childlike on one side. That's the condition we expect from young children, innocent, dependent, trusting, obedient, respectful, anxious to please, all the way across on the other side to childish. The palette of childishness includes selfishness, irresponsibility, boredom, envy, inconsiderate behavior, whining, cowardice, at least frequently, and in general, a lack of emotional proportion and self-discipline. Childish people need to be attended to by adults. That's important, so don't forget it. It's an important clue to what's really going on. Okay, now contrast that childlike to childish continuum with another familiar designation, the word youthful. Youthful offers quite a positive window on human character, opens up an entirely different catalog of adjectives: adventurous, energetic, curious, resilient, indomitable, surprising, open to new experience. Very few schools, including very few private schools, could possibly contain youthfulness, let alone encourage it. I hope you recognize the paradox in that. We have an institutional structure which finds itself compelled to suppress those very qualities which are universally acknowledged to be passports of success in Western society. Schools ask kids to remain childlike well beyond its natural term, but if they can't get childlike, they will settle for its toxic cousin, childish. The most radical thing I have to say to you, I'm going to say now, this has not gone on for a century without it serving some rational purpose. Remember, rationality and reasonableness are two different things. I know you think schools are unreasonable, so do I. That's why you homeschool. But that is a far cry from proving them irrational, and you'll see what I mean as we proceed. Secondary school wasn't the only way to grow up until after 1945. We tend to forget that. Indeed, even 10 years after 1945, the fast food dropout geniuses I talked about earlier were putting together a profound new way of life for all of us without benefit of diplomas or degrees. Even today in wealthy Switzerland, less than one kid in four goes beyond elementary school. If you knew that, would you raise your hand? And yet you live in one of the wealthiest communities on planet Earth, and it's full of sharp people and heavy-duty news reporting. How come, I'm not indicting you, how come no one bothered to tell you that 3 out of 4 kids, more than that, in Switzerland don't go beyond elementary school? You did hear, as I did yesterday and the day before, that Switzerland has just announced that 1 out of every 39 of its citizens are millionaires in terms of cash. That's not counting their stocks, their real estate holdings, just in cash. 1 out of 39 Swiss are millionaires, including many, many people who only have an elementary school education. The school journalists and pedagogues in America haven't bothered to tell you about Switzerland. That in itself is a paradox, don't you think? For most of our own history, most kids did not go to secondary school. Yet the unschooled rose to be admirals like Farragut, inventors like Edison, captains of industry like Carnegie and Rockefeller, presidents like Washington and Lincoln, writers like Herman Melville, or scholars like Margaret Mead. People who reached age 13 were not looked upon as children. I'll give you a shocking example of that. Does anybody in this room possess that history of the world that the readers, Book of the Month Club gives out as a premium if you join? I used to have about a dozen sets of it there. It's by Will and Ariel Durant. It's about 16 volumes. Well, the co-writer of that Book of the Month Club, History of the World, it's rather well regarded. It's been in print for about 40 or 50 years, was married at 13 to the man she stayed married to for over 50 years. Would she really have been better off doing junior high school homework, do you think? The United States had a successful system of education before we got forced institutional schooling. Then why were the training grounds in boredom we call public schools demanded as a replacement? Even the simple matter of physically confining children, immobilizing them, is known to cause damage to health even in the short run, and it sets up negative patterns which tend to persist lifelong. Why was this done? It's a puzzle, and to solve it, we need to track the idea for childlike, childish, unwholesome, and boring schools back to its origin, at least to its proximate origin. And when we do, we wake up in the northern European nation of Prussia about two centuries ago. By 1820, Prussia was teaching the rest of the world that schools could be efficient training grounds for a managed economy and a managed society. Now, I know some of you say, well, we don't have a managed economy. This is a free market. And I'll accept that from you if you can explain to me why Lockheed can go bankrupt and rise back to life again on the back of your tax money, or why Chrysler can go bankrupt and rise back to health with your tax money as a direct subsidy to it. I could go on for quite a long time about the corporations that haven't been able to compete that are still parts of your daily life. School could create obedient political subjects, incomplete people. That's the key. Incomplete people that the state could finish and adjust as it saw fit. Now, that was Prussia. The mechanism to perform this magic was habit training, sensitizing children to be reflexively responsive to propaganda. How well this scheme worked to concentrate state power, the world was soon to learn in three titanic Prussian-inspired wars between 1871 and 1945. And quite apart from its war-enhancing ability, Prussian habit control schooling served the emerging mass production business empires just coming into being. Early on, German psychology, both hard, what we call behavioral, and soft psychologies, saw that school conditioning could make children susceptible to any sort of authoritarian appeal, including those soft core authoritarianisms of advertising and public relations. A few brilliant minds saw what was at stake, nothing less than a way to overturn Adam Smith's implacable laws of supply and demand. If demand could reliably be created for anything and any idea, a managerial revolution would be at hand. In my own recent memory, the most flagrant example of this is the so-called Iraqi war, which 3 weeks before it began was repudiated by the majority of the American population, a strong majority of the American population, plus 62%. And then, with the help of your tax money and mine, an enormous public relations machine was set in motion, and 3 weeks later, a bare majority of the population was in favor of an attack on Iraq. If opinion could be created, I wanted to give you an example of what I'm talking about here. Managers would be free of the tyranny of public opinion. It could be whatever management wanted, in theory at least. With this in mind, and inspired by Asian successes in crowd management brought back to the United States by traders and by dealers in opium, the founders of compulsory schooling aimed from the beginning to collectivize and socialize, there's a word you hear, isn't it, the ordinary population through the inculcation of the habits and attitudes of dependency. Put simply, they worked to extend childhood well beyond its natural limits by arranging for the removal of young people from home and neighborhood surroundings, from adult company, from real responsibility, and then placing them with total strangers, false kin, for the best part of the day. As schools grew larger and remote bureaucracies selected both teaching personnel and curriculum sequences, it was not uncommon for parents to know nothing at all about the people assigned to be the main companions of their offspring. A situation which would have been regarded as fantastic madness or flagrant tyranny for most of our recorded history was now imposed as a daily routine. And to deepen the estrangement, the teachers only appeared to be central figures in this equation. I could say the teachers, the principals, and the superintendents. Actually, they and their own nominal superiors were themselves under the comprehensive direction of managers completely hidden from public view. It was the ancient Spartan E4 arrangement brought back to life. Just a quick visit to ancient history. In Sparta, unlike in Athens, there was an elected president, two elected houses of representatives, a lower house and a higher house, and those elected groups had no power at all. They had the power to debate openly and to draw the public into one side or another, identifying what their inner loyalties were, but actually they had nothing to do with making Spartan policy. It was made by a group of insiders who were known as the E4s. Ancient history, you get everything at the Link Convention, huh? Parents were given the illusion of being in touch with the people who now controlled much of their children's lives, but it was not so. Now let's go back to James Bryant Conant, the president of Harvard, who gave me my first clue about the actual purposes of forced schooling. In a book published in 1949 called The Child, the Parent, and the State, it will be in every large library in California, Conant stated flatly that our familiar dull schools were the result of a coup. A good coup, he thought. Now, when the president of Harvard makes a statement like that in print, there's a good chance that he knows what he's talking about. Isn't that so? But he didn't analyze the coup in depth in that book. He only referred those interested to a book written in 1918 by another Harvard man, Alexander Inglis, to find out how the coup was pulled off and what it was about. For a long time, I couldn't find Inglis's book anywhere. You won't find it in any library, as far as I know, in the United States. So I settled for looking up the author instead, and I discovered to my delight that the honor lecturer in education at Harvard was named after him. For the last 76 years, the Inglis lecture had been kept alive at America's premier university, and that was reason enough to approach this coup thing with heightened interest. And Inglis himself, the coupmeister, had even more to fascinate the coup hunter with. He had been a second-string All-American football player at Amherst at the turn of the 20th century. This is building to something absolutely explosive. So be patient, though. It's not padding. You have to see who these people are who move among you and talk to you. Inglis was a second-string All-American from Amherst, and he had gone from there to head Houghton Mifflin's secondary education publishing division at a time when that publisher virtually controlled pedagogical publishing. If you wanted to know anything about schools past, present, or what was coming, you read books published by Houghton Mifflin or Macmillan at the turn of the century and for a long time afterwards. So being in charge of the gates of publishing in a secondary school was quite an important thing. In that role, he was able to select what the professional public, superintendents and student teachers alike, got to read about the new school industry being born. Most fascinating of all, though, was Inglis's family. I found out that at the time of the American Revolution, one of his ancestors was busy trying to install a state church in America, the State Church of Britain. That fellow fled from his post as Trinity Church's assistant rector to escape Washington's advancing army. Another Inglis relative had written The Refutation of Tom Paine's Common Sense, which is often considered one of the levers that got us into the American Revolution in the first place, but this ancestor had written a refutation of it and was rewarded by Britain by being named the first Anglican bishop of Nova Scotia. And still another Inglis was commanding general at the Siege of Lucknow in India during the Sepoy Uprising in 1857, and he was promoted to major general for gallantry in the face of those rebellious, there's that word again, rebellion, Sepoy wretches. You'll be glad I took you on this brief excursion. When you hear the six purposes of modern confinement schooling as pronounced by Inglis, and with this context in hand, you are ready to see school as a fifth column placed in the path of the burgeoning American libertarian tradition, which you homeschoolers have brought back to life again, I think single-handedly. Schooling is a surgical incision into which class-based management theories of England, to be precise, were to be subtly inserted into the collective American consciousness to interdict the liberty tradition. By infiltrating the minds of children out of the sight of their parents or any other traditional local authority, the trick would be done. Now, the well-educated will not be shocked. Theories from Plato to Rousseau to Frederick of Prussia knew and taught that if children could be kept childlike or childish beyond its term in nature, if they could be cloistered into a limited society of children, held without any real responsibility except obedience, if their inner lives could be attenuated by removing the insights of history, literature, economics, philosophy, religion, music and art, if the imminence of death and the certainty of pain and loss in everybody's life could be removed from daily consciousness, if profound reflections on the certainty of one's own death could be replaced with the trivializing emotions of greed, envy, jealousy, and fear, young people would grow older, but they would never grow up. And if they never grew up, a great enduring problem of supervision would be solved. For who here could argue that childish and childlike people aren't easier to manage than critically trained, self-reliant ones? If you're skeptical, you want to keep in mind the words of Lee Iacocca, CEO of Chrysler, spoken out of your earshot in Argentina. Or do you think he was kidding? Educated people are dangerous. Now you're ready to hear Alexander Inglis on the real purposes of schooling. All the categories are in his original. On some of these, I've added a little interpretation to make the meaning clear. The first function of schooling is adjustive. Schools are to establish fixed habits of reaction to authority. Notice that this precludes critical judgment completely. Notice, too, and this is a biggie, that requiring obedience to stupid orders is a much better test of whether the kid's been properly adjusted than asking him or her to follow sensible orders ever could be, because sensible people always follow sensible orders. So you've got to make sure that they've demonstrated that they've seeded their own judgment and will follow stupid orders. Recall that this list of six comes to you not from John Gatto, not from a conspiracy theory, but from James Bryant Conant's recommendation that if you wanted to understand what schools really were about, you should get a hold of Alexander Inglis's book, The Principles of Secondary Education. So the second function of schooling is the diagnostic function. School is to diagnose each student's proper social role, logging the evidence mathematically and anecdotally on cumulative records. Third comes the sorting function. School is to sort children by training individuals only so far as their likely destination in the social machine, not one step beyond. The fourth function is conformity, but put out of your mind what you think conformity means. As much as possible, kids are to be made alike, not from any passion for egalitarian ideals, but so their future behavior will be mathematically predictable in service to market and government research. Fifth comes the hygienic function, and once again, put out of your mind whatever you think is meant by the word hygiene. It has nothing here to do with health at all of the individual, but a lot to do with the health of the race, at least as Inglis, Galton, and Darwin saw it. Hygiene is a polite way of saying that school is expected to accelerate natural selection by tagging the unfit so clearly that they will drop from the reproduction sweepstakes or be so inept at parenting that their families will collapse and therefore terminate somewhat further down the line. And last of the six functions of schooling is what Inglis called the propaedutic function. That's a fancy word meaning that a small fraction of lucky kids will quietly be taught to take over management of this continuing project guardians of a population deliberately dumbed down and rendered childlike in order that government and economic life can be managed with a minimum of hassle. Now, it's one thing to say you're going to do all those things. That was 1918. And another to actually do them. What, for instance, would the mechanism look like that could reduce people to a state where they would be compliant in such dispositions? While Britain and Germany had conditioned their own populations for centuries to accept paternalistic direction from the political state, it hadn't happened here. And a project of this magnitude could not just be rammed down citizens' throats. They would have to be taught to actually welcome it increment by increment, welcome the extension of childhood and the onset of childishness. If at any point public outrage got too loud, the scheme's managers would have to know enough to retract it a bit and wait until under cover of some national emergency like war or depression or other civil unrest, it could be sent racing forward while people were looking elsewhere.
This is Jim Hightower. You're listening to Radio for Peace International, broadcasting from Costa Rica, bringing you the world from the people's perspective.
You are listening to Radio for Peace International and a speech by John Taylor Gatto. John Taylor Gatto prescribes the difference between homeschooling and home education and how to bring the most out of your children. You are listening to Radio for Peace International. Radio for Peace International is completely listener-sponsored. If you like the speech, please consider logging on to our website, www.rfpi.org, www.rfpi.org, and see how you can help support Radio for Peace International.
That's how the formidable American ability to read and to argue was deconstructed under the drums and tramplings of World War II. The plan, simplified mightily for the purposes of this talk, called for the infantilization of America, the gradual dumbing down, the gradual demoralization, the slow, steady removal of critical responsibilities from families and their transfer to bureaucrats. What I'm talking about is a radical extension of childhood, principally through schooling at first, but in time through every institution, including and especially popular entertainment, under the direction of a small elite which removes the necessity to entertain oneself. But once again, we need to reiterate that childishness is not an objectionable quality to management, but rather its very justification for being. Childish people are unable to offer effective resistance to management. They may whine, complain, even shoot one another, but they have no idea how things work. Childish people, for all the noise they make, are nearly helpless. Eventually, they fall back into line because they have no other choice. They lack inner resources to be self-sustaining. Through the second half of the 19th century, the North German states of Prussia, Saxony, and Hanover, a science of making young people childish grew up. It was studied by certain prominent Americans like Horace Mann or William Torrey Harris. He was the first national superintendent of schools, by the Peabody family, by J.P. Morgan, and by others who envied Prussia the control it offered to management and wanted that control for itself, themselves. With the rise of the centralized corporate economy, a quarter century after the Civil War, another overriding reason to place the population under tight management come about. But before I tell you about that one, I want to get a few red herrings out of the way. There were a lot of groups other than the new corporate class that wanted people kept childish for their own reasons. The utopian socialists like Robert Owen and John Ruskin actually thought that an endless childhood, through an endless childhood, an agrarian utopia could be achieved. The evolutionary crowd like Darwin, Galton, and Herbert Spencer thought most of us, I mean a figure as high as 95%, were biologically retarded and could not ever grow up. It would only make trouble to try. Scientific historians like Hegel or Herder or Marx thought that by keeping people dumb and incomplete, history itself could finally be controlled by small elites and guided to a conclusion. There were others too, but we needn't review them all here. I just wanted you to know that although I'm following the trail of the growing corporation, which oddly enough got its start right here in California in the Supreme Court case Santa Clara versus the Southern Pacific Railroad, 1886, is the first time in human history that a corporation is given all the rights that a human being has. It's that case right here in California. Prior to that time, corporate charters lasted 20 years, sometimes a little longer. The corporation could only do what it had written in its charter, saying it could do. It couldn't conglomerate and swallow other corporations. While the liability was limited, the veil could be penetrated very easily. Corporations were never trusted from their inception to be anything other than very, very dangerous ways to make a state prosperous. But in California in 1886, all that ended, and they got the rights of human beings. Corporations were never allowed to interfere in politics in no country that had them. They could not interfere, could come down on either side, let alone both, as we do here to preempt the debate. Anyway, suffice it to say, there were plenty of interests who wanted the public childish, but none had the resources of corporations to sustain a campaign in that direction. We started here with a picture of McDonald's on the screen. I wonder how many of you realize that the federal government passed a law popularly known to themselves as the McDonald's Law, which allowed the minimum wages to be waived by the fast food corporations, and they could pay 20% under the minimum wages. That was during Nixon's the Nixon administration's freeze on wages and prices. McDonald's was exempted. For a long time, it only required a little corporate financing done behind the scenes to allow an army of innocent academic and philosophical screwballs to do the government corporate bidding unknowingly, thinking they were riding their own hobby horses. Those of you who have ever worked in an American college or university will know this, but I do not think the general public is aware that there is no way to rise in the college university system, no way at all to even retain your job unless you can get corporate grants or foundation grants. Of course, all those foundations are corporate foundations or government grants. You must be able to bring little rivers of money in from the outside, or you last a very short time in the college scene. Well, at that point, getting those grants is life and death. You don't do what you want to get those grants. You put your finger in the wind, find out where the money flow is going, what it wants you to do and say, and that's what you do and say. Now, that's a bit cynical, but I think it's better to raise the notion in your minds that way. I was personally put on the trail of radically extended childhood paid for by business and government by reading the works of Elwood Cubberley, who was a friend of Dr. Conan at Harvard, and Alexander Inglis's partner at Houghton Mifflin, where he edited the elementary school textbooks and Inglis did the secondary school. Cubberley, another California name, was dean of teacher education at Stanford. And while there, he became head of a thing that used to be called the Education Trust. Thank you, Mike. It is a shadowy cabal of academics nationwide who controlled every major administrative post in America by 1918. If you ever want to read about that particular coup, a nice account exists of it in David Tyack's book, Managers of Virtue, which will be for sale in every graduate school of education in California, hardly a conspiracy book. In 1906, Cubberley wrote in his PhD thesis that in the new schools coming, that is the ones that you've escaped and we all have, that the children were to be shaped and fashioned like nails, and the specifications were to come from business and government in that order. I think if you drive onto the Stanford campus, there's either a Cubberley building or there's a little statue up there to Cubberley. Specifications, of course, are terms for outcomes desired. How those outcomes were to be reached was up to the academics and bureaucrats who worked for the policy people. In business, that's known as managing by objectives. A few years later, in 1919, Cubberley wrote that childhood had been deliberately extended by 4 years after the Civil War because a combination of powerful interests demanded this. That's in his History of Education, but it's not in every edition of it. He's about 20 editions of that book. The trick was pulled off by denying children association with the adult world. That's what socialization's about. And with real responsibility, through comprehensive confinement schooling, which creates a world of children separate from the real world. There the little human resources can be held until summoned. It isn't very hard to see that the interest most directly served by delaying personal sovereignty is something we can call the managerial outlook. Total management and human independence are mutually contradictory terms. Once professionalized, management finds it irresistible to argue that neither children nor parents can be trusted. How many times I heard that in my 30 years in the school business. That the only sensible way to handle growing up is through expert goal setting and professional interventions at public expense. It's time we all face the fact that expert management is never well served by allowing children to grow up, even to grow whole. Its tutelage is justified intellectually by the academic disciplines of psychology, sociology, anthropology, evolutionary biology, even military science, each contending in its own way that growing up is impossible for most of us. All of these disciplines grew from corporate or government underwriting at the beginning of this century or at the end of the 19th, along with the statistical techniques which lend them credibility. Somewhat over 100 years ago, the higher academic voices in America set up a litany which communicated that we would remain children forever, always in need of supervision and regulation, the identical message the Prussians had heard a century before that. One recent piece of evidence that our leaders listened to those voices came to me from a press conference held on TV by Vice President Gore's wife just before the election of 2000. In this press conference, Tipper Gore declared that 55% of the American people were mentally disturbed and in need of therapy, and any humane government would be providing that therapy at no cost. I made that last part up. I don't know if she said that. But Mrs. Gore is only one of a host of commentators urging that we be kept under closer and closer surveillance. When speaking to this question of general irresponsibility, observe how very convenient and useful it is that American classrooms are workshops of rudeness, rowdiness, and danger. How better to instruct the oncoming generations that their only hope of safety lies in expert ministrations. At the end of the 20th century, as I showed you a parody of on the screen, 100,000 American schoolchildren were being barcoded in an experiment to track their passages and see to it that each boy and girl is always where someone else thinks they belong. The profound change in the American bargain with its young, the change that dumbing them down and demoralizing them brought about, wasn't the result of popular demand, nor was it caused by prominent socialists like John Dewey, who are often blamed. The transformation was an undertaking of industrial titans like Andrew Carnegie, J.P. Morgan, Vincent Astor, Commodore Vanderbilt, John D. Rockefeller, Henry Ford, and a few others. The private tax-exempt foundations and elite private boarding schools of these men continue their work to this day. How many times during the presidential election of 2000 did you hear that out of the 20 inner circle elite private boarding schools, places like St. Paul's and Gunnery and Hotchkiss, Groton, that not only did George Bush come, but Al Gore also came. And Gore went to St. Andrews, but it's another one that's religiously affiliated. Bush came from Andover. John McCain, that gritty, down-to-earth populist, came from one of the ritziest of all, called Episcopal High in Washington. Steve Forbes came from Brook. Now, there's four of the five or six candidates coming from 20 private schools with an enrollment of about 20 or 25,000 people totally, maybe a lot less than that. Does that sound statistically likely to you? Anyway, remember, these men, though, weren't interested in fine-tuning your schools. They were only interested in outcomes. They left details to underlings like Henry Kissinger or Zbigniew Brzezinski. And we'll be out of here in a little while. And what is the work they're doing? One way to understand it is to see it as a systematic recreation of the class-based, expert-driven managerial society of Anglican Britain, only this time based in supposedly objective scientific principles. Why would an economic leadership committed to Adam Smith's capitalistic principles veer in this decidedly socialistic direction? Fortunately, these men tell us why in their own essays and memoirs and letters and occasional writings that I've been reading for the last 10 years, God forgive me, and are all in that book out there. Carnegie and Rockefeller, for instance, both despised competition. I mean, they went into a blue funk when the idea that competition was the key to our vitality was mentioned. They thought it was irrational and a huge waste of time. As purely rational thinkers, they worked with might and main to stamp it out and replace it with a planetary form of government which would resemble the British Empire and its Anglican corporate theology, only be better and more efficient. By the last quarter of the 19th century, the promise of unlimited energy coupled with mass production machines. Remember that a century earlier, coal wasn't used anywhere. There weren't any trains at all. Oil was some sort of a nuisance that, and again, natural gas that burned off in your fields. But now they had this blank check for energy, and they knew that coupled with mass production machinery, that an industrial utopia could finally come about. But personal liberty and conventional morality would have to be surrendered if that promise was going to be realized. Indeed, as I told you earlier, even the law of supply and demand would be forced to give way. But how were they going to get rid of the libertarian American past? And if you put yourself in these guys' position, I think you see it's a huge task to replace family and tradition and religion. There is nowhere else to start but with children. So drawing on the method pioneered in Prussia, the quick arrival of young Americans at responsible maturity had to be ended. And this is my final, I think, idea to leave with you. It had to be ended because financial capital demanded it. Why would anybody make the huge investments that mass production machinery calls for, machinery that's certain to obsolete itself down the line in 4 or 5 years? Why would anyone make those investments unless profit could be guaranteed? Markets assured. Unless this could be done, capital wasn't going to be forthcoming. Now, assuring markets is an old game. Britain had been doing it for centuries. Competition is muted through trust formation, through government regulation, through government subsidies that stack the market deck, and in other ways unknown to the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker. But not so easy was convincing our uniquely productive population to give up its traditional yearning for independent livelihoods. When the lady asked the audience this morning how many people were doing homeschooling in conjunction with a home business, it was about 35% or 40% of the room, which was as filled as this room is now. That's what had to be put to death. The perils of overproduction would frighten away the investments that industrial growth depended on. The majority of the people would have to be retrained to think of itself as employees and as consumers instead of producers. Even consumers of centrally produced entertainment. Forget the fact that when I was growing up in the 40s, people were singing all the time, not so they could go to Hollywood or get on the charts. There were just singing groups everywhere. There were acting groups everywhere. You couldn't walk down the street on Saturday or Sunday. There must have been 400 painters sitting out in the streets of Monongahela, Pennsylvania. And so mass schooling of a compulsory nature was given teeth between 1905 and 1915. It was no longer charged with fashioning good people or good citizens. Now it was directed, as it had been in Germany, to the inculcation of habits, fears, appetites, and attitudes useful to management. That's all you need to know to understand what standardized testing is about. Keep in mind, Thank you. This scheme was never intended, this is the hardest part to swallow, to be destructive, just the reverse. By converting Americans into specialized economic and social functions, into incompletely human beings, this nation eventually achieved the most reliable domestic market in the world. The human mutilations of schooling are a trade-off for this prosperity, comfort, and security are achieved at the price of personal sovereignty and wholeness. That's what makes extended childhood a paradox. Give it up, and the society will enter a zone of great turbulence, since most people don't have a clue what to do to make a living or how to entertain themselves. And the resolution of that turbulence, nobody can predict, except you and me. Once, because you've already done it. Once you see its logic, the mechanisms of forced schooling are fairly simple to avoid. Well-schooled children are trained to reflexively obey strangers' commands and to continually seek the judgment of strangers. Later on, after school is done, advertising and advocacy journalism paid for by advertisers slip easily into the role of school teacher. Well-schooled people have a low threshold of boredom. They need constant novelty to feel alive. With only the flimsiest inner life, they must stay in touch with official voices through television, radio, internet, cell phone, commercial music, and other commercial entertainments, pop journalism, and shallow friendships turned over on a regular basis. They cannot sit still without their minds wandering off to some commercial world or to the stock market. Changing classes at short intervals is a drill to prepare kids for changing associates, domiciles, mates, and possessions in dizzying and eternal profusion. A climate of low-level dissatisfaction is the very air that centralized mass production economies must breathe, and therefore it is practiced in school. Well-schooled people must be poorly trained in history, philosophy, economics, literature, poetry, music, art, theology, and anything known to develop a personal inner life. Well-schooled people need lifelong tutelage, cradle-to-grave schooling to make any sense of their days. Mass entertainment and mass journalism provide that tutelage long after school is done. What to do about this personally? What to do about it collectively as a society demands that we have to wake up to what school has evolved into. It's a service of big business and big government. If you seek a change in schooling, you're going to have to repudiate that fatal belief that if only government could be given more control, or only business, then all would sort itself out. What to do about it personally? Learn to be a saboteur of this thing. And I know I'm preaching to the choir here. Throw sand into the gears of the machine whenever you can. There's no way to reform it, since it does exactly what it was designed to do. And recognize that the blessing that extended childhood brings to managers and the prosperity it invests the economy with by converting spirits designed for independence into whining, greedy, bored children who define themselves by what they consume is a prize too contemptible to be worth the cost. When you next find yourself appalled by infantile and irresponsible behavior that you see all around you, think of school as its forge and try to get rid of it. Thank you. God bless. Thank you very much. It was worth living to 70. Now you sit down and I'll give you a standing ovation.
This is Julia Butterfly Hill with listener-supported Radio for Peace International, your global community forum.
You have been listening to a speech by John Taylor Gatto. This speech was provided by Friends on Pendragon and given in the year 2001 by John Taylor Gatto when he was 70 years old. Radio for Peace International, broadcasting from El Rodeo, Costa Rica, is completely listener-supported. To see how you can help, please log on to our website, www.rfpi.org, www.rfpi.org. This program was produced by Scott Fratcher. Scott Fratcher is a graduate of the IPC, Institute for Progressive Communications, taught at the grounds of Radio for Peace. To find out more about the IPC, Institute for Progressive Communications, courses taught at the grounds of Radio for Peace, again, log on to our website, www.rfpi.org.
Hi, my name is Larry Freed, and I'm the producer of the Eco Drama Playwrights Festival, otherwise known as Earth Matters on Stage, and we support Radio for Peace International.